the complaints of those who have been plundered, raped, beaten to within an inch of their lives. We have reviewed and considered all the methods of delivering prisoners, and we have found that they are all worse. We have examined the transit prisons, but we have not found any that were good. And even the last human hope that there is something better ahead, that it will be better in camp, is a false hope. In camp, it will be worse. Chapter 4. From Island to Island. And Zexa also moved from island to island of the archipelago simply in solitary skiffs. This is called special convoy. It is the most unconstrained mode of transport. It can hardly be distinguished from free travel. Only a few prisoners are delivered in this way. I, in my own career as a prisoner, made 3 such journeys. The special convoy is assigned on orders from high officials. It should not be confused with the special requisition, which is also signed by someone high up. A special requisition prisoner usually travels on the general prisoner transports, though he, too, meets up with some amazing interludes on his trip, which are all the more extraordinary in consequence. For example, Hans Bernstein was travelling on a special requisition from the north to the lower Volga to join an agricultural mission. He was exposed to all the overcrowded conditions and humiliations I have described, snarled at by dogs, surrounded by bayonets, threatened with 1 step out of line, and then suddenly he was unloaded at the small station at Zenzevatka and met by 1 single, calm, unarmed jailer. The jailer yawned, "All right, you'll spend the night at my house and you can go out in the town as you like till morning. Tomorrow I'll take you to the camp." And Hans did go out. Can you understand what going out on the town means to a person whose term is 10 years, who has already said goodbye to life countless times, who was in a Stolypin car that very morning and will be in camp the next day? And he immediately went out to watch the chickens scratching around in the station master's garden, and the peasant women getting ready to leave the station with their unsold butter and melons. He moved 3, 4, 5 steps to the side, and no one shouted, "Halt!" at him. With unbelieving fingers he touched the leaves of the acacias and almost wept. And the special convoy is precisely that sort of miracle from beginning to end. You won't see the common prisoner transport this time. You don't have to keep your hands behind your back. You don't have to undress down to your skin, nor sit on the earth on your rear end, and there won't be any search at all. Your convoy guards approach you in a friendly way and even address you politely. They warn you, as a general precaution, that in case of any attempt to escape, we do, as usual, shoot. Our pistols are loaded and we have them in our pockets. However, let's go simply. Act natural. Don't let everyone see that you're a prisoner. And I urge you to note how here, too, as always, the interests of the individual and the interests of the state coincide completely. My camp life was totally transformed the day I went out to line up forlornly in the carpenter's brigade. My fingers cramped, they had gotten stiff holding on to tools and wouldn't straighten out. And the work assignment supervisor took me aside, and with unexpected respect said to me, "Do you know that on orders of the Minister of Internal Affairs?" I was stupefied. The line-up dispersed, and the trustees in the camp compound surrounded me. Some of them said, "They're going to hang a new stretch on you," and others said, "To be released." But everyone agreed on one thing, that there was no escaping Minister of Internal Affairs Krugloff. And I, too, swayed between a new term and being released. I'd quite forgotten that 1/2 year before some character had come to our camp and distributed Gulag registration cards. After the war, they had begun this registration in all the nearby camps, but it seems unlikely that it was ever completed. The most important question on it was trade or profession, and the Zeks would fill in the most precious gulag trades to enhance their own value. Barber, tailor, storekeeper, baker. As for me, I had frowned and filled in nuclear physicist. I had never been a nuclear physicist in my life, and what I knew of the field I had heard in the university before the war. Just a little bit, the names of the atomic particles and their parameters. And I had decided to write down, nuclear physicist. This was in 1946. The atom bomb was desperately needed. But I didn't assign any importance to that Gulag registration card, and, in fact, forgot about it. There was a vague, unverified legend, unconfirmed by anybody, that you might nevertheless hear in camp, that somewhere in this archipelago were tiny paradise islands. No one had seen them, no one had been there. Whoever had kept silent about them and never let on. On those islands, they said, flowed rivers of milk and honey, and eggs and sour cream were the least of what they fed you. Things were neat and clean, they said. And it was always warm, and the only work was mental work. And all of it, super, super secret. And so it was that I got to those paradise islands myself. In convict lingo, they are called sharashkas, and spent half my sentence on them. It's to them I owe my survival, for I would never have lived out my whole term in the camps. And it's to them I owe the fact that I am writing this investigation, even though I have not allowed them any place in this book. I have already written a novel about them. And it was from one to another of those islands, from the first to the second, and from the second to the third, that I was transported on a special convoy basis, two jailers and I. If the souls of those who have died sometimes hover among us, see us, easily read in us our trivial concerns, and we fail to see them or guess at their incorporeal presence, then that is what a special convoy trip is like. You are submerged in the mass of freedom, and you push and shove with the others in the station waiting room. You absent-mindedly examine announcements posted there, even though they can hardly have any relevance for you. You sit on the ancient passenger benches and you hear strange and insignificant conversations about some husband who beats up his wife or has left her, and some mother-in-law who, for some reason, does not get along with her daughter-in-law, how neighbors in communal apartments make personal use of the electric outlets in the corridor and don't wipe their feet, and how someone is in someone else's way at the office, and how someone has been offered a good job but can't make up his mind to move. How can he move bag and baggage? Is that so easy? You listen to all this, and the goose pimples of rejection run up and down your spine. To you, the true measure of things in the universe is so clear, the measure of all weaknesses and all passions, and these sinners aren't fated to perceive it. The only one there who is alive, truly alive, is incorporeal you, and all these others are simply mistaken in thinking themselves alive. And an unbridgeable chasm divides you. You cannot cry out to them, nor weep over them, nor shake them by the shoulder. After all, you are a disembodied spirit. You are a ghost, and they are material bodies. And how can you bring it home to them? By an inspiration? By a vision? A dream? Brothers! People! Why has life been given you? In the deep, deaf stillness of midnight, the doors of the death cells are being swung open, and great-souled people are being dragged out to be shot. On all the railroads of the country this very minute, right now, people who have just been fed salt herring are licking their dry lips with bitter tongues. They dream of the happiness of stretching out one's legs and of the relief one feels after going to the toilet. In Orotucan, the earth thaws only in summer and only to the depth of 3 feet, and only then can they bury the bones of those who died during the winter. And you have the right to arrange your own life under the blue sky and the hot sun, to get a drink of water, to stretch, to travel wherever you like without a convoy. So what's this about unwiped feet, and what's this about a mother-in-law? What about the main thing in life, all its riddles? If you want, I'll spell it out for you right now. Do not pursue what is illusory, property and position. All that is gained at the expense of your nerves decade after decade, and is confiscated in one fell night. Live with a steady superiority over life. Don't be afraid of misfortune, and do not yearn after happiness. It is, after all the same. The bitter doesn't last forever, and the sweet never fills the cup to overflowing. It is enough if you don't freeze in the cold, and if thirst and hunger don't claw at your insides, if your back isn't broken, if your feet can walk, if both arms can bend, if both eyes see, and if both ears hear, then whom should you envy, and why? Our envy of others devours us most of all. Rub your eyes and purify your heart, and prize above all else in the world those who love you and who wish you well. Do not hurt them or scold them, and never part from any of them in anger. After all, you simply do not know. It might be your last act before your arrest, and that will be how you are imprinted in their memory. But the convoy guards stroke the black handles of the pistols in their pockets. And we sit there, three in a row, sober fellows, quiet friends. I wipe my brow, I shut my eyes, and then I open them. And once again I see this dream, a crowd of people unaccompanied by guards. I remember clearly that I spent last night in a cell and will be in a cell again tomorrow. But here comes some kind of conductor to punch my ticket. Your ticket? My friend there has it. The cars are full. Well, full in free people's terms. No one is lying under the benches and no one is sitting on the floor in the aisles. I was told to behave naturally, and I have been behaving very naturally indeed. I noticed a seat beside a window in the next compartment and got up and took it. And there were no empty seats for my guards in that compartment. They sat where they were and kept their loving eyes on me from there. In Peribori, the seat across the table from me was vacated. But before my guard could get to it and sit down, a moon-faced fellow in a sheepskin coat and a fur cap, with a plain but strong wooden suitcase, sat down there. I recognized his suitcase. It was camp work, made in the archipelago. Phew! He puffs. There was very little light, but I could see he was red in the face and that he had had a hassle to get on the train. And he got out a bottle. How about a beer, comrade? I knew that my guards were close to a nervous breakdown in the next compartment. I was not allowed anything alcoholic. But still, I was supposed to conduct myself as naturally as possible, and so I said carelessly, "All right, why not?" Beer. It's a whole poem. For 3 years I hadn't had even one swallow, and tomorrow in my cell I would brag, "I got beer." The fellow poured it, and I drank it down with a shiver of pleasure. It was already dark. There was no electricity in the car. This was post-war dislocation. One tiny candle end was burning in an ancient lantern at the door, one for four compartments, two in front and two behind. I talked amiably with the fellow, even though we could hardly see each other. No matter how far forward my guard leaned, he couldn't hear a thing because of the clickety-clack of the wheels. In my pocket I had a postcard addressed to my home, and I was about to explain who I was to my simple friend across the table and ask him to drop the card in a mailbox. Judging by his suitcase, he had been in stir himself. But he beat me to it. "You know, I just barely managed to get some leave. They haven't given me any time off for 2 years. It's a dog's branch of the service." "What kind?" "Don't you know? I'm an MVD man, an Asmodeus blue shoulder boards. Haven't you ever seen them?" Hell, why hadn't I guessed right off? Peribori was the centre for Volgolag, and he had gotten his suitcase out of the Zex. They had made it for him for free. How all this had permeated our life. Two MVD men, two Asmodei, weren't enough in two compartments. There had to be a third, and perhaps there was also a fourth concealed somewhere. And maybe they were in every compartment, and maybe someone else there was travelling by special convoy like me. My fellow kept on whining and complaining of his fate, and at that point I decided to enter a somewhat mystifying demurrer. "And what about the ones you're guarding, the ones who've got 10 years for nothing? Is it any easier for them?" He immediately subsided and remained silent until morning. Earlier, in the semi-darkness, he had noticed that I was wearing some kind of semi-military overcoat and field shirt, and he had thought I was simply a soldier boy. But now the devil only knew what I might be. Maybe I was a police agent. Maybe I was out to catch escapees. Why was I in this particular car? And he had criticized the camps there in my presence. By this time, the candle end in the lantern was floating, but still burning. On the third baggage shelf, some youth was talking in a pleasant voice about the war. The real war, the kind you don't read about in books. He had been with a unit of field engineers and was describing incidents that were true to life. And it was so pleasant to realize that unvarnished truth was, despite everything, pouring into someone's ears. I could have told tales, too. I would even have liked to. But no, I didn't really want to any more. Like a cow, the war had licked away 4 of my years. I no longer believed that it had all actually happened, and I didn't want to remember it. 2 years here, 2 years in the archipelago, had dimmed in my mind all the roads of the front, all the comradeship of the front line, had totally darkened them. One wedge knocks out another. And after spending a few hours among free people, here is what I feel. My lips are mute. There is no place for me among them. My hands are tied here. I want free speech. I want to go back to my native land. I want to go home to the archipelago. In the morning, I deliberately forgot my postcard on an upper shelf. After all, the conductor will get around cleaning up the car. She will carry it to a mailbox, if she is a human being. We emerge onto the square in front of the northern station in Moscow. Again, my jailers are newcomers to Moscow and don't know the city. We travel on streetcar B, and I make the decisions for them. There is a mob at the streetcar stop in the middle of the square. Everyone is on the way to work at this hour. One jailer climbs up to the streetcar motorman and shows him his MVD identity card. We are allowed to stand imposingly on the front platform for the whole trip, as if we were deputies of the Moscow Soviet, and we don't bother to get tickets. An old man isn't allowed to board there. He isn't an invalid, and he has to board in the rear, like the others. We approach Novoslobodskaya and disembark. And for the first time I see Butyrki prison from the outside, even though it's the fourth time I've been brought there, and I can draw its interior plan without difficulty. Woof! What a grim, high wall stretches for 2 blocks there. The hearts of the Muscovites shiver when they see the steel maw of its gates slide open. But I leave the sidewalks of Moscow behind me without regret, and as I enter that tower of the gatehouse, I feel I am returning home. I smile at the first courtyard and recognize the familiar main doors of carved wood. And it's nothing at all to me that they are now going to make me face the wall, and they already have, and ask me, last name, given name and patronymic, year of birth. My name? I am the interstellar wanderer. They have tightly bound my body, but my soul is beyond their power. I know. After several hours of inevitable processing of my body, confinement in a box, search, issuing receipts, filling out the admissions card after the roaster and the bath, I shall be taken to a cell with 2 domes with a hanging arch in the middle. All the cells are like that. With 2 large windows and a long combination table and cupboard. And I shall be greeted by strangers who are certain to be intelligent, interesting, friendly people. And they will begin to tell me their stories, and I will begin to tell them mine, and by night we will not even feel like going off to sleep right away. And on the bowls will be stamped, so we shouldn't make off with them on the prisoner transport. The mark, Bu-Tiyur, for Butyrskaya Tiyurma, Butyrki prison. The Bu-Tiyur health resort, as we mocked it last time. A health resort, incidentally, very little known to the paunchy bigwigs who want so badly to lose weight. They drag their stomachs to Kislovodsk and go out for long hikes on prescribed trails, do push-ups and sweat for a whole month, just to lose 4 to 6 pounds. And there in the Bu-Tiyur health resort, right near them, any one of them could lose 17 or 18 pounds just like that, in 1 week, without doing any exercises at all. This is a tried and true method. It has never failed. One of the truths you learn in prison is that the world is small, very small indeed. True, the Gulag Archipelago, although it extended across the entire Soviet Union, had many fewer inhabitants than the Soviet Union as a whole. How many there actually were in the archipelago, one cannot know for certain. We can assume that at any one time there were not more than 12 million in the camps. As some departed beneath the sod, the machine kept bringing in replacements. According to the researches of the Social Democrats Nikolaevsky and Dalin, there were from 15 to 20 million prisoners in the camps. And not more than half of them were politicals. 6 million? Well, that's a small country, Sweden or Greece. And in such countries, many people know one another. And quite naturally, when you landed in any cell of any transit prison and listened and chatted, you'd be certain to discover you had acquaintances in common with some of your cellmates. And so D, after having spent more than a year in solitary confinement, after Sukhanovka, after Ryumin's beatings and the hospital, could land in a Lubyanka cell and give his name, and then and there a bright chap named F could greet him, "Aha! So now I know who you are." "Where from?" D shied away from him. "You are mistaken." "Certainly not. You are that very same American, Alexander D, whom the bourgeois press lied about, saying you had been kidnapped. And Tass denied it. I was free at the time and read about it." I love that moment when a newcomer is admitted to the cell for the first time. Not a novice who has only recently been arrested and will inevitably be depressed and confused, but a veteran Zek. And I myself love to enter a new cell. Nonetheless, God grant I never have to do it again. With an unworried smile and an expansive gesture. "Hi, brothers." I throw my bag on the bunks. "Well, so what's new this past year in Butyrki?" We begin to get acquainted. Some fellow named Suvorov, of 58. At first glance, there's nothing remarkable about him, but you probe and pry. At the Krasnoyarsk transit prison, a certain Makhotkin was in his cell. "Just a moment, wasn't he an Arctic aviator?" "Yes, they named an island after him in the Taimyr Gulf, and he's in prison for 5810. So does that mean they let him go to do Dinka?"
"How do you know?"
"Yes." Wonderful. One more link in the biography of a man I don't know. I have never met him, and perhaps I never shall, but my efficient memory has filed away everything I know about him. Makhotkin got a whole quarter, 25 years, but the island named after him couldn't be renamed because it was on all the maps of the world. It wasn't a gulag island. They had taken him on at the aviation Sharashka in Bolshino, and he was unhappy there, an aviator among engineers and not allowed to fly. They split that Sharashka in two, and Makhotkin got assigned to the Taganrog half, and it seemed as though all connection with him had been severed. In the other half of it, however, in Rybinsk, I was told that he had asked to be allowed to fly in the far north, and now I had just learned he had been given that permission. This was not information I needed, but I had remembered it all, and 10 days later I turned up in the same Butyrki bath box. There are such lovely boxes in the Butyrki with faucets and small washtubs so as not to tie up the big bath chambers. As a certain R. I didn't know this R either, but it turned out he had been a patient in the Butyrki hospital for half a year and was about to leave for the Rybinsk Sharashka. In another 3 days, the prisoners in Rybinsk too, a closed box where Zeks are cut off from all ties with the outside world, would nevertheless learn that Makhotkin was in Dudinka, and they would also find out where I had been sent. Now this is the prisoner's telegraph system. Attentiveness, memory, chance meetings. And this attractive man in horn-rimmed spectacles? He walked around the cell humming Schubert in a pleasant baritone. "And youth again oppresses me, and the way to the grave is long."
"Tsarapkin, Sergei Romanovich."
"But look here, I know you very well indeed. You're a biologist, a non-returnee from Berlin."
"How do you know?"
"But after all, it's a small world. In 1946, with Nikolai Vladimirovich Timofeyev Rasovsky." Oh, what a cell that had been in 1946. The memories of it returned. It was perhaps the most brilliant cell in all my prison life. It was July. They had taken me from the camp to the Butyrki on those mysterious instructions of the Minister of Internal Affairs. We arrived after lunch, but the prison was so overloaded that the reception processing took 11 hours, and it was not until 3 a.m. that, tired from the boxes, I was admitted to cell 75. Lit by two bright electric bulbs below the two domes, the whole cell slept side by side, restless because of the stuffiness. The hot July air couldn't circulate through the windows blocked by the muzzles. Sleepless flies kept buzzing, and the sleepers twitched when the flies lit on them. Some of the prisoners had put handkerchiefs over their faces to keep the light out of their eyes. The latrine barrel smelled acrid. Everything decayed more quickly in such heat. 80 people were stuffed into a cell for 25, and this was not the limit either. Prisoners lay tightly packed together on the bunks to left and right, and also on the supplementary planks laid across the aisle. And everywhere feet were sticking out from under the bunks, and the traditional butyrki table cupboard was pushed back to the latrine barrel. That was where there was still a piece of unoccupied floor, and that was where I lay down. And thus it was that whoever got up to use the latrine barrel before morning had to step across me. When the order, "Get up!" was given, shouted through the swill trough in the door, everything started to stir. They began to take up the planks from across the aisle and push the table to the window. Prisoners came up to interview me to find out whether I was a novice or a camp veteran. It turned out that two different waves had met in the cell, the ordinary wave of freshly sentenced prisoners being sent off to camp, and a reverse wave of camp inmates who were all technical specialists, physicists, chemists, mathematicians, design engineers, all being sent to unknown destinations to some sort of thriving scientific research institutes. At this point I relaxed. The minister was not going to hang a new stretch on me. I was approached by a man who was middle-aged, broad-shouldered yet very skinny, with a slightly aquiline nose. "Professor Timofeyev Rasovsky, President of the Scientific and Technical Society of Cell 75. Our society assembles every day after the morning bread ration next to the left window. Perhaps you could deliver a scientific report to us. What precisely might it be?" Caught unaware, I stood before him in my long, bedraggled overcoat and winter cap. Those arrested in winter are foredoomed to go about in winter clothing during the summer, too. My fingers had not yet straightened out that morning and were all scratched. What kind of scientific report could I give? And right then I remembered that in camp I had recently held in my hands for 2 nights the Smythe Report, the official report of the United States Defense Department on the first atom bomb, which had been brought in from outside. The book had been published that spring. Had anyone in the cell seen it? It was a useless question. Of course, no one had. And thus it was that fate played its joke, compelling me, in spite of everything, to stray into nuclear physics, the same field in which I had registered on the Gulag card. After the rations were issued, the Scientific and Technical Society of Cell 75, consisting of 10 or so people, assembled at the left window, and I made my report and was accepted into the society. I had forgotten some things, and I could not fully comprehend others, and Timofeyev Rasovsky, even though he had been in prison for a year and knew nothing of the atom bomb, was able on occasion to fill in the missing parts of my account. An empty cigarette pack was my blackboard, and I held an illegal fragment of pencil lead. Nikolai Vladimirovich took them away from me and sketched and interrupted, commenting with as much self-assurance as if he had been a physicist from the Los Alamos group itself. He actually had worked with one of the first European cyclotrons, but for the purpose of irradiating fruit flies. He was a biologist, one of the most important geneticists of our time. He had already been in prison back when Gebrak, not knowing that, or perhaps knowing it, had the courage to write in a Canadian magazine, "Russian biology is not responsible for Lysenko. Russian biology is Timofeyev Rasovsky." And during the destruction of Soviet biology in 1948, Gebrak paid for this. Schrödinger, in his small book, What is Life?, twice cited Timofeyev Rasovsky, who had long since been imprisoned. And there he was in front of us, and he was simply bursting with information concerning all possible sciences. He had that breadth of scope which scientists of later generations don't even want to have. Or is it that the possibilities of encompassing knowledge have changed? And even though at the moment he was so worn down by the starvation of the interrogation period, that these exercises were very difficult for him. On his mother's side, he was descended from impoverished Kaluga gentlefolk who had lived on the Ressa River, and on his father's side he was a collateral descendant of Stepan Razin, and that Cossack energy was very obvious in him, in his broad frame, in his basic soundness, in his determined struggle with his interrogator, and also in the fact that he suffered from hunger more than we did. And his story was this. In 1922, the German scientist Vogt, who had founded the Brain Institute in Moscow, had asked to have two talented graduate students sent abroad to work with him permanently, and that was how Timofeyev Rasovsky and his friend Sarapkin had been sent off on a foreign assignment with no time limit. And even though they did not have any ideological guidance there, they nonetheless achieved great things in science. And when in 1937 they were instructed to return to their homeland, this seemed to them, since it meant interrupting their work, impossible. They could not abandon either the logical continuation of their own researches or their apparatus or their students. And, no doubt, they also couldn't do it, because back in the motherland they would have been compelled to pour shit publicly all over their 15 years of work in Germany. And only that would have earned them the right to go on existing. And would it have earned it for them? And so they became non-returnees, remaining patriots nevertheless. In 1945, the Soviet armies entered Buch, a northeastern suburb of Berlin, and Timofeyev Rasovsky and his entire institute joyously welcomed them. Everything had worked out in the best possible way, and now he would not have to be separated from his institute. Soviet representatives came to inspect it and said, put everything in packing cases and we'll take it all to Moscow. That's impossible, Timofeyev objected. Everything will die on the way. The installations have taken years to set up. The bigwigs acted astonished, and very shortly after that, Timofeyev and Sarapkin were arrested and taken off to Moscow. They were naive. They had thought that the Institute would not be able to operate without them. Well, even if it didn't operate, the general line of the party must triumph. In the big Lubyanka, it was very easily proven to the arrested individuals that they were traitors of the motherland, or to it. And they were sentenced to 10 years, and now the president of the Scientific and Technical Society of Cell 75 took heart from the thought that he hadn't made any errors. In the Butyrki cells, the arched metal frames supporting the bunks were very, very low. Even the prison administration had never thought of having prisoners sleep under them. Therefore, you first tossed your neighbour your coat so that he could spread it out for you under there, and then you lay face down in the aisle and crawled your way in. Prisoners walked through the aisle, the floor underneath the bunks was swept maybe once a month, and you could wash your hands only during the evening trip to the toilet, and even then without soap. And it was thus impossible to say that you could perceive your body as a divine vessel. But I was happy. There, on the asphalt floor, under the bunks, in a dog's den, with dust and crumbs from the bunks falling in our eyes, I was absolutely happy, without any qualifications. Epicurus spoke truly. Even the absence of variety can be sensed as satisfaction, when a variety of dissatisfactions has preceded it. After camp, which had already seemed endless, and after a 10-hour work day, after cold, rain, and aching back, oh, what happiness it was, to lie there for whole days on end, to sleep, and nevertheless receive a pound and a half of bread and 2 hot meals a day, made from cattle feed, or from dolphin's flesh. In a word, the Butyr health resort. To sleep was so important, to lie there on one's belly, to cover one's back, and just to sleep. When you were asleep, you didn't spend your strength nor torment your heart. And meanwhile your sentence was passing, passing. When our life crackles and sparks like a torch, we curse the necessity of spending 8 hours uselessly in sleep. When we have been deprived of everything, when we have been deprived of hope, then, bless you, 14 hours of sleep. But they kept me in that cell 2 months, and I slept enough to make up for the past year and the year ahead. And during that time I moved forward under the bunks to the window, and then all the way back to the latrine barrel, but on the bunks this time, and then on the bunks I moved to the archway. I was sleeping very little by this time. I was gulping down the elixir of life and enjoying myself. In the morning, the Scientific and Technical Society, then chess, books. Oh, those itinerant books. There were only three or four for 8 or 10 people, and there was always a waiting list for them. Then a 20-minute walk outdoors, a major chord. We never refused our walk, even when it was raining heavily. And the main thing was people, people, people. Nikolai Andreevich Semyonov, one of the creators of the Dnieper Hydroelectric Dam and Power Station. His POW friend, the engineer F.F. Karpov. Witty, caustic Viktor Kagan, a physicist. The musician and conservatory student Volodya Klempner, a composer. A woodcutter and hunter from the Vyatka forests, as profound as a forest lake. An orthodox preacher from Europe, Yevgeny Ivanovich Divnich. He did not confine himself to theology, but condemned Marxism, declaring that no one in Europe had taken it seriously for a long time. And I defended it, because after all I was a Marxist. And even a year ago I would have confidently demolished him with quotations. How disparagingly I would have mocked him. But my first year as a prisoner had left its mark inside me. And just when had that happened? I hadn't noticed. There had been so many new events, sights, meanings, that I could no longer say, they don't exist, that's a bourgeois lie. And now I had to admit, yes, they do exist. And right at that point my whole line of reasoning began to weaken, and so they could beat me in our arguments without half trying. And again the POWs kept coming and coming and coming. This was the second year of the wave of them that kept unceasingly coming from Europe. And once more there were Russian émigrés from Europe, from Manchuria. One went about among the émigrés seeking news of acquaintances by first asking what country they had come from, and did they know so-and-so? Yes, of course they did. And that is how I learned of the execution of Colonel Yasevich. And the old German, that portly German, now emaciated and ill, whom I had once upon a time back in East Prussia, was it 200 years ago, forced to carry my suitcase. Oh, how small the world really is. Strange fate that brought us together again. The old man smiled at me. He recognized me, too, and even seemed pleased by our meeting. He had forgiven me. He had been sentenced to 10 years, but he certainly didn't have anywhere near that long to live. And there was another German there, too, lanky and young, but unresponsive, perhaps because he didn't know one word of Russian. You wouldn't even take him for a German right off the bat. The thieves had torn off everything Germany had on and given him a faded old Soviet field shirt in exchange. He was a famous German air ace. His first campaign had been in the war between Bolivia and Paraguay, his second in Spain, his third Poland, his fourth over England, his fifth Cyprus, his sixth the Soviet Union. Since he was an ace, he could certainly not have avoided shooting down women and children from the air. That made him a war criminal, and he got a prison sentence and a muzzle of 5 additional years. And, of course, there had to be one right-thinking person, like Prosecutor Kretov, in the cell. They were right to imprison all you counter-revolutionary bastards. History will grind up your bones for fertilizer. You're going to be fertilizer yourself, you dog, they shouted back. No, they will reconsider my case. I'm innocent. And the whole cell howled and seethed. And a grey-haired Russian language teacher stood up on the bunks barefoot and wrung his hands like a latter-day Jesus Christ. Children of mine, make peace with one another, my children. And they howled at him, too. Your children are in the Bryansk forests. We are nobody's children. All we are is the sons of Gulag. After dinner and the evening trip to the toilet, night cloaked the window muzzles and the nagging electric lights below the ceiling lit up. Day divided the prisoners, and night drew them closer together. There were no quarrels in the evening. Lectures and concerts were given. And in this, too, Timofeyev Rossovsky shone. He spent entire evenings on Italy, Denmark, Norway, Sweden. The émigrés spoke about the Balkans, about France. Someone delivered a lecture on Le Corbusier. Someone else delivered one on the habits of bees. Someone else on Gogol. This was when we smoked our lungs full. Smoke filled up the cell and hovered in the air like a fog, and there was no draught to pull it out the window because of the muzzles. Kostya Kula, twin to me in age, round-faced, blue-eyed, amusingly awkward, stepped up to the table and recited to us the verses he had composed in prison. Kostya Kula doesn't respond. He's disappeared. I am afraid he's not among the living. His voice broke with emotion. His verses were entitled, My First Food Parcel, To My Wife, To My Son. When in prison you strain to get by ear verses written in prison, you don't waste a single thought on whether the author's use of syllabic stress is faulty and whether his lines end in assonances or full rhymes. These verses are the blood of your own heart, the tears of your own wife. The cell wept. In that cell I myself set out to write verses about prison, and it was there that I recited the verses of Yesenin, who had almost, but not quite, been on the forbidden list before the war. And young Bubnov, a POW, and before that apparently a student, who had not completed his studies, worshipfully gazed at those reciting, his face aglow. He was not a technical specialist, and he hadn't come from camp, but he was on his way there, and because of the purity and forthrightness of his character, he would in all likelihood die there. People like him don't survive there, and for him and for others, their fatal descent braked for the moment. The evenings in Cell 75 were a sudden revelation of that beautiful world which exists and will continue to exist, but which their own hard fate hadn't given them one little year of, not even one little year of their young lives. The swill trough dropped down, and the turnkey's mug barked at us, Bed! No, even before the war, when I was studying at two higher educational institutions at the same time, and earning my way by tutoring, and striving to write too. Even then I had not experienced such full, such heart-rending, such completely filled days as I did in Cell 75 that summer. But listen, I said to Sarapkin, I've heard since then from someone called Dierl, a 16-year-old boy who got a fiver, not on a school report card, for anti-Soviet propaganda. What, do you know him too? He was an our prisoner transport to Karaganda. I heard, I continued, that you were given work as a laboratory assistant doing medical analyses, and that Timofeyev Rasovsky was constantly being sent out on general assignment work. Yes, and he grew very weak. He was half dead when they brought him from the Stolypin car here to the Butyrki. And he is in a hospital bed here right now, and the 4th Special Department is issuing him cream and even wine. But it's hard to say whether he will ever get back on his feet again. The task of the 4th Special Department of the MVD was to solve scientific problems using prisoners. Did the 4th Special Department summon you? Yes, they asked us whether we considered it might still be possible after 6 months of Karaganda to start setting up our institute here, in the fatherland. And you, of course, agreed enthusiastically. Most certainly. After all, we have come to understand our mistakes. And besides, all the equipment wrenched from its original place and put into packing cases got here even without us. What dedication to science on the part of the MBD. May I ask for a little more, Schubert? And Sarapkin sang softly, staring sadly at the window, his spectacles reflecting both their dark muzzles and their light upper sections. Vom Abendrot zum Morgenlicht ward mancher Kopf zum Greiser. Wer glaubt es, meiner war des nicht auf dieser ganzen Reise. Tolstoy's dream has come true. Prisoners are no longer compelled to attend pernicious religious services. The prison churches have been shut down. True, their buildings remain, but they have been successfully adapted to enlarge the prisons themselves. 2,000 additional prisoners have thereby been housed in the Butyrki church, and in the course of a year, estimating an average turnover of 2 weeks, another 50,000 will pass through the cells in what was once the church. On arriving at the Butyrki for the 4th or 5th time, hurrying confidently to my assigned cell, through the courtyard surrounded by prison buildings, and even outstripping the jailer by a shoulder, like a horse that hurries without the urging of whip or reins, home to where the oats are waiting. I sometimes even forgot to glance at the square church rising into an octagon, It stood apart in the middle of the courtyard quadrangle. Its muzzles were not machine-made of glass reinforced with iron rods as they were in the main section of the prison. They were rotten, unplaned grey boards, pure and simple. And they indicated the building's second-rank priority. What they maintained there was a kind of intra-Butyrki transit prison, so to speak, for recently sentenced prisoners. And at one time, in 1945, I had experienced it as a big, important step, when they led us into the church after our OSO sentencing. And that was the right time to do it, too. It was a good time for prayer. Took us up to the second floor, and the third floor was also partitioned off, and from the octagonal vestibule distributed us among different cells. Mine was the southeast cell. This was a large square cell in which at the time 200 prisoners were confined. They were sleeping as they did everywhere else there, on the bunks, and they were one-story bunks, under the bunks, and just simply on the tile floor, out in the aisles. Not only were the muzzles on the windows second-rate, everything else, too, was in a style appropriate not to true sons of Butyrki, but to its stepsons. No books, no chess sets, no checkers were distributed to this swarming mass, and the dented aluminum bowls and beat-up wooden spoons were collected and removed from one mealtime to another, for fear that in the rush they might get carried off on prisoner transports. They were even stingy with mugs for the stepsons. They washed the bowls after the gruel, and then the prisoners had to lap up their tea slops out of them. The absence of one's own dishes was particularly acute for those who experienced the mixed blessing of receiving a parcel from their families. Despite their meagre means, relatives made a special effort to provide parcels in those last days before the prisoner transports left. The families had had no prison education themselves, and they never got any good advice in the prison reception office either, and therefore they didn't send plastic dishes, the one and only kind prisoners were allowed to have, but glass or metal ones instead. All these honeys, jams, condensed milks were pitilessly poured and scraped out of their cans through the swill trough in the cell door into whatever the prisoner had, and in the church cells he had nothing at all, which meant that he simply got it in the palms of his hands, in his mouth, in his handkerchief, the flaps of his coat, which was quite normal in gulag terms, but not in the centre of Moscow. And at the same time the jailer kept hurrying him as if he were late for his train. The jailer hurried him because he was counting on licking out whatever was left in the jars. Everything was temporary in the church cells, without that illusion of permanency which existed in the interrogation cells, and in the cells where prisoners awaited sentencing. Ground meat, a semi-processed product partially prepared for gulag. The prisoners were unavoidably here those few days, until a bit of space had been cleared for them at Krasnaya Preznya. They had just one special privilege here. 3 times a day they were allowed to go for their gruel themselves. No grits were given out here, but the gruel was served 3 times a day, and this was a merciful thing because it was more frequent, hotter, and stuck to the ribs better. This special privilege was allowed here because there were no elevators in the church, as there were in the rest of the prison, and the jailers had no wish to exert themselves. The big, heavy kettles had to be carried from a long way off, across the yard, and then up a steep flight of stairs. It was hard work, and the prisoners had very little strength for it, but they went willingly, just to get out into the green yard one more time and hear the birds singing. The church cells had their own air. It held a fluttering presentiment of the drafts of future transit prisons, of the winds of the Arctic camps. In the church cells you celebrated the ritual of getting adjusted to the fact that your sentence had been handed down and that it wasn't in the least a joke, to the fact that no matter how cruel the new era of your life might be, your mind must nevertheless digest and accept it. And you arrived at that with great difficulty. And you had no permanent cellmates here as you did in the interrogation cells, which made the latter something like a family. Day and night, people were brought in and taken away, singly and by tens, and as a result the prisoners kept moving ahead along the floor and along the bunks, and it was rare to lie next to any one neighbour for more than 2 nights. Once you met an interesting person there, you had to question him immediately, because otherwise you would miss out for good and all. and that is how I missed out on the automobile mechanic, Medvedev. When I began to talk to him, I remembered that his name had been mentioned by the Emperor Mikhail. Yes, he had indeed been implicated in the same case as Mikhail, because he had been one of the first to read the Manifesto to the Russian People, and had failed to write a denunciation. Medvedev had been given an unforgivably, shamefully light sentence, 3 years. And under Article 58, too, for which even 5 years was considered a juvenile sentence. They had evidently decided the Emperor was really insane, and had been easy on the rest of them because of class considerations. But I had hardly pulled myself together to ask how Medvedev regarded all this, than they took him off with his things. Certain circumstances led us to conclude that he had been taken off to be released, and this confirmed those first rumours of the Stalinist amnesty which reached our ears that summer. The amnesty for no one. An amnesty after which everything was just as crowded as before, even under the bunks. They took my neighbour, an elderly Schutzbündler, off to a prisoner transport. Here, in the land of the world proletariat, all those Schutzbündlers who had been suffocating in conservative Austria had been roasted with tenors, and on the islands of the archipelago they met their end. And there was a swarthy little fellow with coal-black hair and feminine-looking eyes like dark cherries, but with a broad, larger-than-usual nose that spoiled his whole face, turning it into a caricature. For a day he and I lay next to each other in silence, and on the second day he found occasion to ask me, "What do you think I am?" He spoke Russian correctly and fluently, but with an accent. I hesitated. There seemed to be something of Transcaucasia in him, Armenian, presumably. He smiled. "I used to pass myself off very easily as a Georgian. My name was Yasha. Everyone laughed at me. I collected trade union dues." I looked him over. His was truly a comical figure, a half pint, his face out of proportion, asymmetrical, his smile amiable. And then suddenly he tensed up, his features sharpened, his eyes narrowed, and cut me like the stroke of a black sabre. "I am an intelligence officer of the Romanian General Staff, Lieutenant Vladimirescu." I started. This was real dynamite. I had met a couple of 100 fabricated spies, and I never thought I might meet up with a real one. I thought they didn't exist. According to his story, he was of an aristocratic family. From the age of 3, he had been destined to serve on the General Staff. At 6, he had entered the Intelligence Service School. Growing up, he had picked his own field of future activity, the Soviet Union, taking into account that here in Russia the most relentless counterintelligence service in the world existed, and that it was particularly difficult to work here because everyone suspected everyone else. And, he now concluded, he had worked here not at all badly. He had spent several pre-war years in Nikolaev, and it appears had arranged for the Romanian armies to capture a shipyard intact. Subsequently, he had been at the Stalingrad tractor factory, and after that at the Urals heavy machinery factory. In the course of collecting trade union dues, he had entered the office of the chief of a major division of the plant, had shut the door behind him, and his idiotic smile had promptly left his face, and that sabre-sharp cutting expression had appeared. "Ponomariev!" And Ponomariev was using an altogether different name at the Urals heavy machinery factory. "We have been keeping track of you from Stalingrad on. You left your job there." He had been some kind of bigwig at the Stalingrad tractor factory. "And you have set yourself up here under an assumed name. You can choose to be shot by your own people or to work with us." Ponomariev chose to work with them, and that indeed was very much in the style of those super-successful pigs. The lieutenant supervised his work until he himself was transferred to the jurisdiction of the German intelligence officer resident in Moscow, who sent him to Podolsk to work at his specialty. As Vladimirescu explained to me, intelligence officers and saboteurs are given an all-round training, but each of them has his own narrow area of specialization. And Vladimirescu's special field was cutting the main cord of a parachute on the inside. In Podolsk, he was met at the parachute warehouse by the chief of the warehouse guard. Who was it? What kind of person was he? Who at night led Vladimirescu into the warehouse for 8 hours? climbing up to the piles of parachutes on his ladder and managing not to disturb the piles, Vladimiresko pulled out the braided main support cord and with special scissors cut 4/5 of the way through it, leaving 1/5 intact, so that it would break in the air. Vladimiresko had studied many long years in preparation for this one night, and now, working feverishly, in the course of 8 hours he ruined, according to his account, upwards of 2,000 parachutes. 15 seconds per parachute?
I destroyed a whole Soviet parachute division!
His cherry-like eyes sparkled with malice. When he was arrested, he refused to give any testimony for 8 whole months. Imprisoned in the Butyrki, he uttered not one word. And didn't they torture you?
No.
His lips twitched as though to indicate he didn't even consider such a thing possible in the case of a non-Soviet citizen. Beat your own people so foreigners will be more afraid of you, but a real spy's a gold mine. After all, we may have to use him for an exchange. The day came when they showed him the newspapers. Romania had capitulated. Come on now, testify. He continued to keep silent. The newspapers could have been forgeries. They showed him an order of the Romanian General Staff. Under the conditions of the armistice, the General Staff ordered all its intelligence agents to cease operations and surrender. He continued to keep silent. The order could have been a forgery. Finally, he was confronted with his immediate superior on the General Staff, who ordered him to disclose his information and surrender. At this point, Vladimirescu cold-bloodedly gave his testimony, and now, in the slow passing of the sale day, it was no longer of any importance, and he told me some of it, too. They had not even tried him. They had not even given him a sentence. After all, he wasn't one of our own. I am a career man, and will remain one until I die, and they won't waste me. But you are revealing yourself to me, I pointed out. I might very well remember your face. Just imagine our meeting some day in public.
If I am convinced that you haven't recognized me, you will remain alive. If you recognize me, I will kill you or else force you to work for us.
He had not the slightest desire to spoil his relationship with his cell neighbor. He said this very simply, with total conviction. I was really convinced that he wouldn't hesitate for a moment to gun someone down or cut their throat. In this whole long prisoner's chronicle, we will not again meet such a hero. It was the only encounter of the sort I ever had in my 11 years of prison, camp, and exile, and others didn't even have one. And our mass circulation comics try to dupe young people into believing that these are the only people the organs catch. It was enough to look around that church cell to grasp that it was youth itself the organs were catching in the first place. The war had ended, and we could allow ourselves the luxury of arresting everyone who had been singled out. They were no longer needed as soldiers. They said that in 1944 and 1945, a so-called Democratic Party had passed through the cells of the small Moscow province, Lubyanka. According to rumor, it had consisted of 50 boys, had its own statutes and its own membership cards. The eldest of them was a pupil in the 10th grade of a Moscow school, and he was its general secretary. Students were also glimpsed fleetingly in the prisons during the last year of the war. I met some here and there. I was presumably not old myself, but they at any rate were younger. How imperceptibly all that crept up on us, while we... I, my co-defendant, and others of our age, had been fighting for 4 years at the front. A whole new generation had grown up here in the rear, and had it been very long since we ourselves had tramped the parquet floors of the university corridors, considering ourselves the youngest and most intelligent in the whole country, and, for that matter, on earth? And then suddenly pale youths crossed the tile floors of the prison cells to approach us haughtily, and we learned with astonishment that we were no longer the youngest and most intelligent. They were. But I didn't take offense at this. At that point I was already happy to move over a bit to make room. I knew so very well their passion for arguing with everyone, for finding out everything. I understood their pride in having chosen a worthy lot, and in not regretting it. It gave me goose flesh to hear the rustle of the prison halos hovering over those self-enamored and intelligent little faces. 1 month earlier, in another Butyrki cell, a semi-hospital cell, I had just stepped into the aisle and had still not seen any empty place for myself, when approaching in a way that hinted at a verbal dispute, even at an entreaty to enter into one, came a pale, yellowish youth with a Jewish tenderness of face, wrapped, despite the summer, in a threadbare soldier's overcoat shot full of holes. He was chilled. His name was Boris Gamarov. He began to question me. The conversation rolled along, on one hand our biographies, on the other politics. I don't remember why, but I recalled one of the prayers of the late President Roosevelt, which had been published in our newspapers, and I expressed what seemed to me a self-evident evaluation of it. Well, that's hypocrisy, of course. And suddenly the young man's yellowish brows trembled, his pale lips pursed. He seemed to draw himself up, and he asked me, Why do you not admit the possibility that a political leader might sincerely believe in God? And that is all that was said. But what a direction the attack had come from, to hear such words from someone born in 1923? I could have replied to him very firmly, but prison had already undermined my certainty, and the principal thing was that some kind of clean, pure feeling does live within us, existing apart from all our convictions. And right then it dawned upon me that I had not spoken out of conviction, but because the idea had been implanted in me from outside. And because of this I was unable to reply to him, and I merely asked him, "Do you believe in God?" "Of course," he answered tranquilly. "Of course." "Of course." "Yes." "Yes." The Komsomols were flying ahead of the flock, everywhere, but so far only the NKGB had noticed. Notwithstanding his youth, Boryo Gamarov had not only fought as a sergeant in an anti-tank unit with those anti-tank 45s the soldiers had christened Farewell Motherland, he had also been wounded in the lungs, and the wound had not yet healed, and because of this TB had set in. Gamarov was given a medical discharge from the army and enrolled in the biology department of Moscow University. And thus two strands intertwined in him, one from his life as a soldier, and the other from the by no means foolish and by no means dead student's life at war's end. A circle formed of those who thought and reasoned about the future, even though no one had given them any instructions to do so. And the experienced eye of the organs singled out three of them and pulled them in. In 1937, Gamarov's father had been killed in prison or shot, and his son was hurrying along the same path. During the interrogation, he had read several of his own verses to the interrogator with feeling. And I deeply regret that I have not managed to remember even one of them, and there is nowhere to seek them out today. Otherwise, I would have cited them here. For a number of months after that, my path crossed those of all three co-defendants. Right there in a Butyrki cell, I met Vyacheslav D., and there is always someone like him when young people are arrested. He had taken an iron stand within the group, but he quickly broke down under interrogation. He got less than any of the others, 5 years, and it looked as though he was secretly counting a good deal on his influential papa to get him out. And then, in the Butyrki church, I encountered Georgi Ingal, the eldest of the three. Despite his youth, he was already a candidate member of the Union of Soviet Writers. He had a very bold pen. His style was one of strong contrasts. If he had been willing to make his peace politically, vivid and untrodden literary paths would have opened up before him. He had already nearly finished a novel about Debussy, but his early success had not emasculated him, and at the funeral of his teacher, Yuri Tanyanov, he had made a speech declaring that Tanyanov had been persecuted, and by this means had assured himself of an 8-year term. And right then, Gamarov caught up with us, and while waiting to go to Krasnaya Preznia, I had to face up to their united point of view. This confrontation was not easy for me. At the time, I was committed to that world outlook which is incapable of admitting any new fact or evaluating any new opinion before a label has been found for it from the already available stock, be it the hesitant duplicity of the petty bourgeoisie, or the militant nihilism of the déclassé intelligentsia. I don't recall that Ingal and Gamarov attacked Marx in my presence, but I do remember how they attacked Lev Tolstoy, and from what direction the attack was launched. Tolstoy rejected the church, but he failed to take into account its mystical and its organizing role. He rejected the teachings of the Bible, but for the most part modern science was not in conflict with the Bible, not even with its opening lines about the creation of the world. He rejected the state, but without the state there would be chaos. He preached the combining of mental and physical work in one individual's life, but that was a senseless leveling of capabilities and talents. And finally, as we see from Stalin's violence, an historical personage can be omnipotent, yet Tolstoy scoffed at the very idea. In my pre-prison and prison years, I too had long ago come to the conclusion that Stalin had set the course of the Soviet state in a fateful direction. But then Stalin died quietly, and did the ship of state change course very noticeably? The personal, individual imprint he left on events consisted of dismal stupidity, petty tyranny, self-glorification. And in all the rest, he followed the beaten path exactly as it had been signposted, step by step. The boys read me their own verses and demanded mine in exchange, and I as yet had none. They read Pasternak, particularly, whom they praised to the skies. I had once read My Sister Life, and hadn't liked it, considering it precious, abstruse, and very, very far from ordinary human paths. But they recited to me Lieutenant Schmidt's last speech at his trial, and it touched me deeply because it applied so to us. For 30 years I have nurtured my love for my native land, and I shall neither expect nor miss your leniency. Gamarov and Ingal were just as shiningly attuned as that. We do not need your leniency. We are not languishing from imprisonment, we are proud of it. But who is really capable of not languishing? After a few months, Ingal's young wife renounced and abandoned him. Gamarov, because of his revolutionary inclinations, did not even have a sweetheart yet. Was it not here, in these prison cells, that the great truth dawned? The cell was constricted, but wasn't freedom even more constricted? Was it not our own people, tormented and deceived, that lay beside us there under the bunks and in the aisles? Not to arise with my whole land would have been harder still, and for the path that I have trod, I have no qualms at all. The young people imprisoned in these cells under the political articles of the code were never the average young people of the nation, but were always separated from them by a wide gap. In those years, most of our young people still faced a future of disintegrating, of becoming disillusioned, indifferent, falling in love with an easy life, and then, perhaps, beginning all over again the bitter climb from that cozy little valley up to a new peak, possibly after another 20 years. But the young prisoners of 1945, sentenced under 5810, had leapt that whole future chasm of indifference in one jump, and bore their heads boldly erect under the axe. In the Butyrki church, the Moscow students, already sentenced, cut off and estranged from everything, wrote a song, and before twilight sang it in their uncertain voices. 3 times a day we go for gruel, the evenings we pass in song. With a contraband prison needle, we sew ourselves bags for the road. We don't care about ourselves any more. We signed, just to be quicker. And when will we ever return here again from the distant Siberian camps? Good Lord, how could we have missed the main point of the whole thing, while we had been ploughing through the mud out there on the bridgeheads, while we had been cowering in shell holes and pushing binocular periscopes above the bushes? Back home, a new generation had grown up and gotten moving. But hadn't it started moving in another direction? In a direction we wouldn't have been able and wouldn't have dared to move in. They weren't brought up the way we were. Our generation would return, having turned in its weapons, jingling its heroes' medals, proudly telling its combat stories. and our younger brothers would only look at us contemptuously. Oh, you stupid dolts. End of part two. This concludes the reading of Volume 1 of The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Copyright 1973 by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. This recording of the reading of The Gulag Archipelago was published by arrangement with Harper & Row Publishers, Incorporated, and was produced in 1989 by Classics on Tape, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without the prior written authority from Classics on Tape. This book was read by Frederick Davidson. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.